Okay, any questions from last time?
It's a bit random, but do you know how the polarization vector, four vector, transforms as a Lorentz transformation? So I found out, I don't know if that's true, that you can write up to a phase that it will be like lambda mu nu, and then like just the polarization vector itself, but not at the same point, not at the lambda transform, not at the transform point, and then you have like up to a phase you can have. So because this preserves the orthogonality with momentum and the orthogonality among themselves.
I didn't understand the question. So what's the question?
So I mean, how can you transform like the polarization vector into like the if you want to evaluate epsilon mu, but that instead of a p would be like lambda p, for example.
Okay. Yeah, you're asking what's the formula for it?
Yeah, I'm thinking like something like up to a phase times lambda mu nu epsilon nu of p, not lambda p, but just because I verified that this preserves the orthogonality among themselves and with p mu.
The thing you're asking me is you want to know what's the formula for epsilon mu of p lambda, you know, as a function of p.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean how to transform that. How to transform. Yeah. I can do.
Yeah, but a good answer would be what? So the way you transform it is the thing is this might be an offline question rather than a real time question, but it's. But if you, in broad brushstrokes, what you do is, you know, you have this usual story. So then, you know, you slap U inverse of lambda, and then you do that here, and then you have the two ways of transforming things, right? Because on the one hand, or I guess in this case, you're trying to derive how this thing transforms. So what you would do is you take U inverse on this. You know how the particle states transform, so you know that's some specific thing. And then nothing happened to these guys because they were just numbers, right? So, but then what you can do is you can do changes of variables of the momentum, to make it look like this in the new frame. And at the top of my head, I'm not going to be able to write down what this formula is, but that's the thing where we can work it out. But the rules for how these things transform are coming from, you know, if you did the same thing for f mu nu, there's the coefficient, the epsilon mu nu that would have appeared here is this thing we're looking for here times p nu, because this thing, if we demand this thing transform like an anisometric tensor, and demand this guy to be a massless spin one thing, it dictates what this guy is, and it's p mu times this epsilon nu. And so you read off how this thing transforms just in the usual way you do for all fields from this guy. And then,
well, I mean, I got that, but
yeah.
But maybe we can talk about this like after
that. Yeah, so the thing is that what I'm not sure of is whether or not you're saying, so you know from this how this guy transforms, how do I see that it's a vector up to a gradient, or you're saying I don't know how it transforms yet?
Yeah, I'm just trying to see like how the, because when you do that, like then you're gonna have, when you do your change of variable, as you said.
Yeah, yeah.
Then the epsilon becomes epsilon of not of p but of lambda inverse p, and then we want to express that in terms of the other one, like the other epsilon. So that's kind of like the...
Okay. Yeah. So maybe this is probably a question that it's best to sit down and look at it.
Makes sense.
But you know what the way it normally works is that the way you're defining this for any p is you're defining it from the standard p, so the either the rest frame or the moving in for light-like particles moving in a specific direction, you take the specific Lorentz boost that takes you from that frame to the generic p that you want to talk about, and then you have it act on this guy. Because you define this guy for the other momenta that are not standard to be that specific boost acting on. So I think you know that already. So that's not the answer to what you're asking. Okay, sounds good.
is not the vector. The way that we've got this actually the consequence.
Okay. All right. So again, everything's beeping, and I don't know if that's. Let me just make sure that I don't have stupid things that are running here that. But in particular, there's no mail there. That's... So the last, you know, foundational thing would be the, you know, the spin half fields and, you know, the racology. So the, you know, the, this is, I think, going to be something that you all know, in the sense that we're going to arrive at standard Dirac spinners. And the only thing that's really, so I'll be kind of telegraphic for that. But the main thing to get across here is the logic of it. So the you know, the Dirac equation is going to emerge as kind of a from representation theory as opposed to anything dynamical. And also, I want to have the conventions. We're all on the same page for conventions for spinners, and and I want to give you the, you know, the various identities we're going to use. I want to record them with the signs that are believable and that I can trust, and the is that beeping coming from my laptop or is it coming from
yes.
from here? Yeah, it's and the thing is that I'm not sure. I don't see anything here that's on that would be normally giving those kind of messages. So if I change,
it's not a message. It's something that connects and disconnects. I don't know why.
Yes, that's right. That's what it sounds like, right? It's so who would what would possibly be disconnecting and connecting? That makes it sound like that's a system thing, because the only thing that's been connected is that thing that we're connected to this system here. So it's kind of funny that, anyway, mystery of the universe. So,
it's kind of like so funny that you just make up words with people that name.
That's right. Verbing weird's language, right? So, usual story, right? So the I guess that's the other thing I wanted to get. There's a whole story about Dirac versus Weyl versus Majorana, which I'd like to kind of have people be happy with, because there's two different stories with the same names, and there's an issue of whether a particle is a Majorana particle or a Dirac particle, which is logically independent of the question. That's a physics question. And then there's just a notational thing about whether I describe a system using Majorana fields or Weyl fields or Dirac fields, which is just a convenience thing. And so I want to kind of, along the way, one of my goals is to be have us on the same page for that. So then I got to the wrong page here. Where am I? Ah, that's because it's written down. So the, you know, the field content, you remember we have these AB representations for the Lorentz group, the finite dimensional ones. And the ones that can represent spin a half particles, the smallest ones that represent spin a half particles were the 1/2 0 representation or the 0 1/2 representation. And this is what we're gonna call left-handed fermion, and this is the right-handed one. And just to remind you how they differ, you know, the in this AB representation, we have two, you know, we have 2x2 representations of the Lorentz transformations, and they're being built out of SU2 representations, whose generators we're calling A and B. So there's, you know, A I, if you like, the generators, the 2x2 generators that are representing the first SU2 and the second one are just the Pauli matrices. Of course, they act on different spaces because these are, you know, it's a product group. And then if you remember the connection, if you knew how the A's were acting on some sort of a state, then you knew that the J's were basically 1/2, you know, AI plus BI, and the K's, the boosts were, you know, I, A, J is 1/2 AI minus BI. So the A's and B's are emission. The group elements, you know, typical group element would be for the SU2 would be E to the I, you know, theta I, ji, or ai. That would be a group element as a function of theta, you know, with parameter theta. So it's an explicit 2x2 matrix, which you're getting by exponentiating these explicit 2x2 matrices. And so the boosts and the rotations are just linear combinations of those. So what I want to start with is the Dirac field, because that's where we're heading. You know, if we think about the electron is a spin 1/2 particle. So what I'd like to do is write down the field that describes the electron. Electron is so it's spin 1/2, and it's got charge. It's got electric charge. Charge minus E. And the significance of the charge, for the purpose of what I want to say now, is that its antiparticle cannot be it itself. So that means that it's distinct from the anti-electron or the positron. That means that, you know, the destruction operator for the electron, let's call it C just to distinguish it from the photon. You know, that can't be equal to the antiparticle one, unlike for the photon. And because it's spin 1/2 and it's massive, I guess I should say it's massive, we know that we have both the labels for the states, these sigmas. Sigma is equal to plus or minus 1/2. So the spin 1/2 is, you know, the total spin j is 1/2. And those are the eigenstates, eigenvalues of J3 on the particle states. So that was the way we represented the little group for this massive particle. So there will be a field representation in the usual way, with the usual constraints on what it can look like. So we have to choose the field representation. And what I'd like to do is whatever this thing is, we're going to be interested in a parity invariant theory. And so and parity takes these guys into each other. And parity acts on the electron, you know, by itself. So the field I want to use to represent electron is going to be the sum of these two. We're going to need both of them, because one of these guys will be describing, say, the electron, or the left-handed electron, and the other one will be describing the right-handed electron. So those will be the two spin states. They're not really handedness eigenstates because they're not massless states, but altogether we're going to have four spin states, two spins for the electron, two spins for the positron, and I'm going to need two of these guys to have enough fields to describe that. And so since we're going to be interested in a theory that's parity invariant, we want one of each rather than two of those, because we want to have something where the left-handed and the right-handed guys get mapped into each other. So the field we're going to use, the field choice, the standard one is to choose the 1/2 0 plus the 0 1/2 representation. And so that means that you know, our field psi, I won't write the indices, but it's a four component thing, 2 times 2, or 2 plus 2. And so it's going to have four numbers in it. And I'm going to be working in a basis where, because this is a reducible representation, you know, the Lorentz transformations act here, and they act here, and they don't map them into each other because they're separate representations. So I'm going to choose this to be the, you know, the 1/2 0 guy, and this to be the 0 1/2 guy. And so I'm going to be guaranteed that when we make the Lorentz transformation matrices, they're going to be 4x4 matrices. So if I take U of lambda psi of x, U inverse of lambda, it's going to be a 4x4 matrix acting on psi, you know, lambda x. And in this 2x2 way of writing things, we're going to have something here, you know, a matrix and another matrix here, but we're going to get zeros here. And that's just saying that these two halves separately rotate, and you don't have to worry about them. They don't rotate into each other as you do Lorentz transformations. So this will be M left and M right. They don't have to be the same matrix. They will be different matrices. But we know what those matrices are because this is telling us. So, you know, if I ask what angular momentum looks like. So if I ask, what do A and B look like here? You know, this guy is in the 1/2 0 representation, so it only sees A. And this guy is in the 0 1/2 representation, so it only sees B, because this is A is 0, B is 1/2, A is 1/2, B is 0. That means that if I write out the matrix, you know, A, that's going to be, you know, 1/2 sigma I, 0, 0, 1, or 0, sorry. And then the matrix B will similarly be 0, 0, 0, 1/2 sigma I, the matrices B. And so from that, you can figure out what the J's and the K's are. And in particular, you know, J will be 1/2 sigma I. I don't think there's an 1/2 here. I think it's just a sum. 0, 0, 1/2 sigma I. And the K will be, so we're going to have, the B will come in with a negative sign, and I'm going to multiply everybody by minus I. So that this will be minus I for the A, and it'll be plus I for the B. The K will be minus I over 2 sigma. Let me not use I as a label here, just because we already have an I going on as the square root of minus 1. So if you want to know how Lorentz transformations work on the field, you know, this is the answer. And then we exponentiate these guys, you do some rotation, you exponentiate those guys, you do a boost, you exponentiate those guys. And these guys are not Hermitian, so this is not a unitary representation, as it can't be because it's finite dimensional. And I'm telling you that because, you know, what we want to do is we want to write the field psi of x as being sum over spins, you know, sigma equals plus or minus 1/2, integral d3p. There's going to be the standard conventional factors. We'll have a destruction operator, cp sigma, e to the ipx, and then there's going to be some column vector. And this is, I'm not writing the indices, but if I put the label 1, 2, 3, 4 here for these indices, that would be, call that, you know, A. Then this would have carried an A, so it's a spinner. And then there's going to be an antiparticle part. And then it'll have a spinner. And mostly what I'm setting up now is what these U's and V's are. And the way we do that is the standard way. You know, the general consistency conditions said that if you do a Lorentz transformation, so that, you know, the statement is that I slap a U inverse around this thing and I get one of these transformations. I slap U, and the same U inverse around these guys makes these the P's and the sigmas transform the way they're supposed to as particles. And then we're just asking what the U has to be to make the both sides consistent. And the conditions we got from that had two forms. One of them was the answer in a general frame where P is not in the rest frame is obtained from the one, it's, you know, defined to be obtained from the one in the rest frame by doing this specific Lorentz transformation that goes from the rest frame to the frame where the rest momentum becomes P. And then the consistency part of the story was if we specialize to something in the little group, which doesn't change the special frame, then the action of the symmetry on the field had to be consistent with the action of the symmetry on the particles. And it was a consistency, it wasn't telling you how U of P is related to U of zero, it was just a consistency condition on U of zero. So for the special case of lambda in the little group, or before I say that, so we build, you know, U of P sigma, and there's a similar story for V, which I'll come to at the end. You know, starting from, or by boosting U of zero sigma, and then, and the little group action is a constraint on U of zero sigma. And so what is that constraint? You're basically asking the U to the action of the little group guys. For massive particles, the little group is rotations, and so it's these J's. And the requirement that the constraint requirement is that we want the action of the rotations for the particles to be the same as the action for the rotations for fields. And in particular, the label sigma is supposed to be the eigenvalue of the J3, right? Because it's the thing that J3 on P sigma is equal to sigma on that rest frame guy. And so a special case of the consistency condition is that when we hit that spinner U with the J3 here, we should be getting the same eigenvalue. So if we use the standard basis for the Pauli matrices, so if I just write that here, so I take sigma 1 to be 0, 1, 1, 0, sigma 2 to be 0 minus I, 0, and sigma 3 to be 1, 0, 0, minus 1, then it's already diagonal. And so this requirement that J3 acting on the field gives the same information as J3 acting on the particles says that this U should satisfy that So J3 acting on U 0 sigma equals sigma U of 0 sigma. What that says, it basically tells us what these U's are in the rest frame. So U 0 sigma equals plus a half will just be 1 over root 2. And I have to be in the plus a half eigenstate of both these sigma 3's. So it's going to be 1, 0, 1, 0. And U of 0 sigma equals minus a half. It's the same thing. It's going to be 1 over root 2, 0, 1, 0, 1. So I'm just kind of making copies of the, they're doing exactly the same thing. And then, not surprisingly, we had 4 slots, but we only have 2 conditions there, and we don't have 2 spin states. So they satisfy, there's a matrix relation between them, right? And that says that, that U of sigma of 0, sigma equals plus a half, is equal to the matrix beta times U of 0, sigma equals minus a half, where the matrix beta is just the block diagonal matrix. These are 2 by 2 things, it's 0, 0, unit matrix, unit matrix. So it's the thing that swaps the top 2 and the bottom 2 guys. And it's clear that these both satisfy that. For any sigma, this is true. It's not that they're related to each other in that way. It's just that beta is just these are eigenvectors of unit eigenvalue for beta. Yeah.
Yeah. So these conditions on J3. So the U must be an eigenvalue of J3. So do we get that from? Because like in your notes, you have the constraint equation of the, on massive So when you have like the U with zero, so the little group, the constraint on the little group,
yeah,
it's expressed in terms of like the representation matrices.
Yeah.
So I would assume that you get that from simplifying this in the.
Yes. Okay. Right. And I'm just taking the special case that that's the statement about the, any arbitrary rotation. And I'm just taking the special one where I rotate around the three axis.
Oh yeah.
And so that's kind of, and it's just basically telling you that the J3 has to do the same thing to this particle as to the field. So that's how I kind of, these were the states that are sigma 3 equals plus.
Yeah.
So you're just doing it twice. So now in the general frame, what we do is we're supposed to boost away from the, so in general frame, there'll be a matrix, you know, D, which depends on L of P. And U of P sigma will be given by, you know, this D of L of P acting on U, P sigma. And I'm going to write down what that is in a second explicitly as a matrix. Sorry, this is 0. So we know what it is at 0. This is how we're going to build it for arbitrary P. So we just need to know what this D is. And this L is the same Lorentz transformation we've been talking about right away, right from the beginning. The one that's in those notes explicitly written. It's a specific boost that takes the rest, you know, rest frame four vector to any arbitrary time-like mass of P. So before I tell you what D is explicitly, or maybe why don't I just tell you what D is explicitly, and then the thing I was going to say afterwards, I can still say afterwards. So if I do that, this turns out to be 1 over root 2, goes along for the ride. Now what you know about this thing is it's going to be block diagonal, right? If I write this thing out as a bunch of 2 by 2 blocks, what you know is that it's 0 and 0 here, because all Lorentz transformations have this property that they're block diagonal, because this is, you know, this was a reducible representation. So that's for free. The only question is what's here, and it turns out to be the square root of p squared plus m squared, so the energy basically, minus the unit vector in the direction of p dot the Pauli matrices times the square root of, this is the square root of the energy plus the mass. This is the square root of the energy minus the mass. And then down on the bottom side, it's the same thing, but with a plus sign in between. So square root of the energy plus the mass plus, and there's a factor of, no, good, p hat dot sigma square root of energy minus the mass. So if we're at rest, in particular, these square roots turn off. So you lose the Pauli matrix. These things just become 2 times the mass. And so what happens to the dimension? I must have forgotten a square root of mass here. Oh, no, it's fine. If we're using the thing that has to have no dimensions is there. And I pulled out a factor of the square root of the energy. And this is equal to the square root of mass, and that square root of mass is going to cancel that square root of energy and give you something dimensionless. This is u of 0. Excuse me. There it is as an explicit function of p. Get engine? Okay. Would you be able to write the subscripts a little larger? Okay, thanks for the signal. Okay, and so the subscripts, right, I'll do that. Is there any particular one you want me to clarify now? Yeah. The box matrix, oh yeah, this one. All right, so let's, I'll just write that bigger. Thank you for that.
Factor missing of square root of m over the energy.
I'm not so sure, but let's just let me write it first again. The first one is a minus. So what do you think we need?
Yeah, no, it was just in the thing you erased. So it, like with the matrix product, like I think there was a factor of square root of m over the energy that was missing.
So where would you put it? Where would you put it?
No, not here, like the thing you erased, but you know, the one you erased when it was just like a matrix product, but not explicit, like with the DLP. Like it's just not DLP times zero, but it's like that times epsilon.
So I think I don't disagree with what your intent is, but I think so. The thing is, because I've written the, I think what you said would be literally true if I had not written the square root of energy there.
Oh yeah.
And then the whole answer would have had that square, because it has to have the square root of energy. And so what I've done is I've used a convention where I've written that, because I'm doing that for all the other fields. I'll do that explicitly there. Oh. And because of that, this thing looks like it's funny. It's going to have the dimensions of square root of mass. And it's true that square root of mass is going to be the one that gives the dimensions right when it hits that energy. That's so this is consistent with our statement for what happens when it's at rest. And this constraint here, this identity that says that the U is a unit eigenvector for the matrix beta, in a general frame, what does that turn into? It says that if I... You know, if I do a Lorentz transformation, I'll have d of lambda times so what I have is beta u of zero sigma is equal to u of zero sigma. So if I hit that with a d of lambda, u of zero sigma, so that'll be u of p of, let me just do L of p. That'll be u of p of sigma. On this side, I'm going to get d of L. I won't write it the p, beta d inverse of L d of L u of 0 sigma. And so, just give myself a little bit of space here. And so, I'm going to call this, this is something which depends on, you know, this is a function of the, this combination here is a function of p mu, because that's how these L's are defined. And this is, again, just u of p sigma. And so I wanted to write this as, and here's where convention matters. Let me. I'm pretty sure I can get this convention right. I just have to, I won't necessarily get it right the first time, but I'll get it right. So I'm going to write this as minus I. It depends on p mu. It's basically going to be linear in p mu. And you can kind of see that because this thing involves the square root of energy. When I take two of them, like I'm going to do here, I'm going to get something which is basically linear in p. So I'm going to call, these p's are going to be summed into something. I'm going to call that matrix gamma mu, and I'm going to divide it by m. So that, this so far is a definition. That's what this matrix, I'm telling you what gamma mu is in terms of these d's, and then this u of p's sigmas there. So this statement turns into, for a general frame, you knew that these four component things, these u's, they were redundant, because they only had the two spins in them. And that was what this told you. It said that, that of all the possibilities, we just had two combinations of the four. So that means that there was a way of expressing that in a basis-independent way, and that was that it was this matrix beta. There are eigenvectors of that matrix beta. In a general frame, there must be a translation of that condition, and this is what it is. It's saying that these u's are unit eigenvectors for this matrix. And if I've done that right, and I have done that right, then another way of writing this is, or I guess I can tell you what these gamma matrices, what these gammas are. So if I take this definition, where those are the d's, and I just figure out what the gammas are by factoring out the p, then gamma zero will, or sorry, gamma zero will be, if I had been in the rest frame, this would have just been the energy, and I would have had the then that's the mass that cancels, so it'd be minus I. So minus I gamma zero must be beta, because that's what this was supposed to be in the rest frame. So that means that gamma zero is I beta, which is the matrix, you know, zero, I, zero. And then it turns out that the other gammas, so gamma k, and there's three of them, one for each space direction. Those are given by, and here's where I'm going to need to get the conventions right. Did I get that right? Yes, I did. These are given again by, you know it's going to be off diagonal because you know that beta was off diagonal by definition, and you know that the d's are all acting only in the top, and they're diagonal. So when I slap a d on both sides of beta, I'm going to get something that's still off diagonal. So I'm going to get zero here, zero here. And then what plays the role of the off diagonal piece is minus I times the Pauli matrix, and here it's I times the Pauli matrix. And so what's special about these guys is there's two things that are going on. So the first thing to notice is another way of writing this. So the statement that u is equal to minus I p mu gamma mu over m on u, another way of writing that is I p mu gamma mu plus m on u is equal to zero. And that's the Dirac equation. And so in this way of doing it, you're seeing that the Dirac equation is just emerging as a consequence of the representation of the spinners, which kind of made sense because it's like when we were doing the representation of the bosons, p squared plus m squared equals zero was built in from the get-go because the states satisfied that. And this kind of carries that information. If I hit it with a minus I p mu gamma mu plus m, I would get the condition that p squared plus m squared is zero. So this is the Dirac equation. If I had asked, what does that imply for the field psi, that field psi, it means that the, at least so far for the u-dependent part as opposed to the v-dependent part, it says that gamma mu partial mu plus m on psi of x should be zero. That would be the translation of this statement into position space. What about the v's? So the v's, the story that led us to the u's was a uniqueness, it was a unique up to normalization story. The same thing is true for the v's. And the solution in general for the v's is that if you give me in any AB representation, so if I take the v's, the solution for them in terms of the u's is it's minus to the 2b times minus to the j minus sigma times u of p and minus sigma. And that's because you're using the fact that the complex conjugate of a particle is transforming the same way as the particle is if the masses are the same and the spins are the same. And so you can solve for these v's in terms of the u's, and this is what the solution turns out to be. And so in this particular example, minus to the 2b, that's the matrix gamma, I'm going to call it gamma 5. It's something which is a when b is equal to 0, which is the top two components, that's equal to 1. And then when b is equal to a half, which is the bottom two components, is equal to minus 1. And it's something which is there's nothing on the off diagonals because it's a number, not a matrix. And so it's these states that we're looking at are eigenstates of it. So I'm going to define this matrix to be that particular thing. And this is something because it's block diagonal and it's yet a unit matrix in the diagonal, that's something which commutes with all the Lorentz transformations because the Lorentz transformations are always acting in here. And so for free, you know that gamma 5 commutes with the d of lambda for any lambda. Whereas that won't be true for beta, right? Because beta, you know, we've seen it already here, that beta is mapping the top to the bottom. And so Lorentz transformation has changed that. So if I write this out in the rest frame, so v of 0 sigma equals plus a half. So what I have to do is I have to take, I've got a, it'll be 1 over root 2 times something. And so what's going to be, this is a 1 for the top half guy, minus, if I'm looking at sigma equals plus a half, j is equal to a half in this case, so sigma equals a half, this is just 1. So that these two are both 1. And so it's just going to be given by, in the top slot, it's going to be given by the u for the other spin. That'll be 0, 1. And in the bottom slot, the only thing that changes is, actually both these things change, I guess, because b will be now a half, so this will be minus 1. But this doesn't change because we're still talking about sigma equals a half. So this will be 0 minus 1. And similarly, v of 0, p equals minus, or sigma equals minus a half, is 1 over root 2. The only thing that's changing now is that this thing is becoming, instead of being 1, it's now minus 1. But this factor is the same, and this is the same. So it's going to be minus 1, 0, 1, 0. So if I act on this, again, it's an eigenstate of beta. So if I take beta acting on v of 0, sigma, this time I get minus v of 0, sigma. So these v's are not the same vectors as the u's in the sense that they're, the v's were the unit eigenvectors, and these are the negative unit eigenvectors for beta. And so that means that if we do the same argument to go to a general frame, what will happen is that if we take v of t sigma to be d of l v of 0 sigma, then this condition turns into the same matrix that we had before, minus I, p mu gamma mu over m. That matrix acting on v is, instead of being equal to itself, it's equal to minus itself. Which means that if I write it like that, it says now that it's minus I, p mu gamma mu plus m acting on v that's equal to 0. So if I was thinking of this as a algebraic equation, you know, this is an explicit matrix because I've given you the gammas and you know what the p's are. You can solve this equation to find what these two b's are. That's another way of finding them. And it has the same information. And the reason you get a different answer from here is because they're the opposite eigenvalue of this particular thing. And that's the thing. That is what has to be true of the negative frequency part in order to have it do the same thing as the positive frequency part and make this true. So this is the same information as that and that. And the fact that they're different is coming in because of the momenta are coming in differently for the derivatives up there. The last thing is, you can also see from this that if we started taking...
Question.
Oh, yes. Sorry, question? So to check the motivation, the idea was that we know d of l represent a boost to p, and that u beta u inverse should be some matrix. So to connect them, we want to write the matrix as a sum over p mu gamma mu, so we can then find the form of our gammas. Yeah. So I'm using the fact that this combination here is in secret linear in the four momenta, and so given that it's linear in the four momentum. And the time component of the four momentum is the energy here. So the fact that this is a complicated function of p doesn't mean that it's not linear. But you've got a square root here and a square root here. When you put two of them in there, you're going to get something linear in the four momentum. And it's that fact is what's allowing me to factor out the p and then call the rest of this is all just convention. I divide by m to make it dimensionless, and then the minus I is a pure convention. And so that defines four matrices. And what's special about those matrices is it's suggestive writing them with a four-vector index like this. It's suggestive. If I now start acting on this thing with d of lambda for arbitrary lambda, this is going to be true for all frames. We should be able to figure out how this matrix changes if we start going to random frames. And what will happen is that d of lambda gamma mu d inverse of lambda just turns into, you know, lambda nu mu gamma nu. And so the these particular matrices are nice because they transform in a simple way under Lorentz transformations. And so that's kind of why this equation isn't a frame-specific equation, that it's consistent to think of it in any frame. And this is nice because this makes that another way of saying this statement is that we know that if we had a spin a zero, a half representation, we took a tensor product with a zero, a half zero with a zero, a half, that should have been a four vector, a one half, one half. And this is going to be the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient that makes a four vector out of two spinners. So we're still missing one thing in order to make that explicit, but we're going to make bilinears of spinners with this sandwiched in between. And this index mu is going to play the role of a vector index in the way that it, the notation suggests it does. And it's because of this transformation property that it's behaving under a Lorentz transformation the way that a vector would have behaved. That's what makes those such nice matrices. Oh, good. Right. And so having said that, there's a convention. It's useful to take, you know, so matrices acting on these spinners, you know, are there 4x4 matrices, right? So there's 16 independent kinds of matrices that can act on a four-component spinner. So if I think of the space of 4x4 matrices, you know, M, so it's a 4x4. There's 16 bases. If I think of that as a vector space, any matrix that's 4x4 can be a linear combination of a basis set, but there's going to be 16 things in that basis set. Could have been, you know, could have chosen the basis to be 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, or 0, 1, 0, 0. But there's a convention. We can choose a basis which transforms nicely under Lorentz transformations, given that we know about these guys. And we know about this guy. So a convenient, so 16, a 16 useful basis vectors, or basis matrices. So the basis in the sense of any arbitrary 4x4 matrix can be written as a linear combination of these guys. And because they're going to have nice Lorentz transformation properties, the coefficients will also transform nicely under Lorentz transformations. So the unit matrix, that's certainly a Lorentz invariant thing. I take d inverse, I get it back. Gamma 5, we've already seen, commutes with the Lorentz transformations. So if I take d inverse on that, I get it back. So it's a Lorentz scalar. It's a pseudo scalar, turns out. You see, for parity and time reversal, it does something, but it doesn't do anything for the other ones. Gamma mu, we just seen, is a four vector, basically. So another four vector I could get would be gamma mu times gamma 5. And so that's, so far I've got 1, 2, plus 4 is 6, plus 4 is 10. I'm missing 6 of them. And the remaining 6 that transform in a nice way, I'm going to call gamma mu nu. And that's an anti-symmetric thing, so it's equal to minus gamma nu mu. And I'm going to take that to be 1 half the commutator of gamma mu with gamma nu. And those are all linearly independent. And one way to see that is that you can give the space of 4x4 matrices an inner product. And the inner product would be, if I give me m two matrices, m and n, the inner product, I'll just be the trace of the product, m, n. And these things all satisfy that if I take m and n to be each one of these, then they're all orthogonal with this inner product. And so it's any matrix can always be written as a linear combination of these 16 of them. And if you take a specific matrix, you know, C is equal to, I should be able to write it as being, let me go to another blackboard.
So okay, can I just see the last?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
I was about to write something here which I didn't finish, so I'll finish that in the next board. This is 1/2. Sometimes people use I over 2, but I'm using 1/2.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, to have the normalization with that inner product.
Like, let me just make sure I'm not lying to you. It's a. I think you're right that it's been a while since I've done that normalization calculation. Yeah.
Okay.
Part of the choice, sometimes the metric choice, you have minus plus 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 metric versus plus minus 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 metric. It impinges these choices because a property that I haven't told you yet, but I might as well say it now, is I'll put it here because we can erase it later on. If so, not, you know, those matrices, you know them explicitly now, so you can just calculate their anti-commutator, gamma mu, gamma nu, and that's twice the metric. So in particular, gamma 0 squared is the eta 0, 0, which is minus 1 in the metric I'm using, which means that gamma 0 wants to be imaginary, or anti-Hermitian. And the spatial guys are going to want to be Hermitian. And then whether or not your gamma zeros are imaginary or not impinges on whether or not you want factors of I over gamma and gamma mu nu, because take the zero I piece, for example, the hermeticity properties of it will depend on what your metric was. So sometimes you'll see things that are have factors of I running around that are traceable to the metric conventions.
Yeah.
And since I've got a board open here, I'll just do the thing I was going to say. If you give me some random matrix C, 4x4 matrix, there has to exist, so let's call it C1 times unit matrix, a bunch of coefficients. I should be able to always find these coefficients. C mu times gamma mu, C5 mu times gamma mu, gamma 5, C mu nu times 1/2 gamma, or times gamma mu nu. And the way you find the coefficients is you just multiply by one, because of that inner product story, is just multiply through by one of these guys and take the trace. So if I want C5, I take gamma 5 times C, the trace of that, and that'll be basically C1 times the trace of gamma 5, which is 0 explicitly because it's 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1. C5 times the trace of gamma 5 squared, which is 1, so that'll be 4. C5 times this, the trace of this is 0, the trace of this is 0, the trace of this is 0. And so you can do the same thing for C1 and so on. And so the way you can write this, once you know what all these traces are, it's straightforward to kind of take any matrix and decompose it in that way, which we'll come back to later on because that's really useful.
It's a Fields transformation, right?
That's the special case of this is a Fields transformation. So if I took a dyadic of two fields, a spinner and an anti-complex conjugate spinner, that's a special case of a matrix, and I can just do this for that, yeah. Right. And the other thing I wanted to tell you was, actually, that's it. Probably that's there's the, so the what I want to head towards is Weyl and Majorana spinners. Yes. Okay. So let's do that over here. Why do you think it's more than six? It's like it's like the electromagnetic field, right? It's an anti-symmetric combination of 4x4 things. So if I write out in mu nu space, it's zeros along the diagonal because it's anti-symmetric, and then I have three things, two things, one thing, so it's six. And these guys are the negative of it. So it's like saying that E and B are the six components of F mu nu.
I guess I'm having a hard time counting
because
I'm used to this block addition.
Well, because we're counting in mu nu space as opposed to spinner space, right? Yeah. And I'm going to try and avoid ever writing a spinner index. So I want to use matrix notation for the spinners just because otherwise you get indices all over the place. All right. I guess I should have said this is something, one more thing we can do for free. So, you know, if Lorentz transformations take psi, take some spinner to d of lambda times the spinner, then psi dagger goes to psi dagger times d dagger of lambda. But that's not equal to psi dagger times d inverse of lambda because these d's are not unitary. And they're not unitary because of the board I just erased here, that the finite dimensional representations can't be unitary here. And although the exponentials of the j's are unitary because the j's are Hermitian, the k's were not Hermitian because they were I times Pauli matrices. So their exponentials are not unitary. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to get to the statement that I can make bilinears of two fermions, which transform like tensors. But for that, I need to have a notion of, if I have gamma mu acting on a fermion, I want to have another fermion I can multiply it by that will transform in the opposite way to make all the D's cancel. And I can't take a psi dagger matrix psi and expect that to transform in a simple way. But the statement is that the reason this works, so there's an identity that poly matrices satisfy, right? If I take a poly matrix and I take its complex conjugate as opposed to its Hermitian conjugate, that's just minus times the second poly matrix times, this is for any poly matrix, times sigma 2. And you can just do it by elimination, right? For sigma 2 itself, sigma 2, I probably erased it. No, sigma 2 is imaginary. So sigma star is minus sigma 2. Sigma 2 star is minus sigma 2, but sigma 2 also commutes with sigma 2, and so the sigma 2 squared is 1, so this is consistent there. And for the other two, sigma 1 and sigma 3, they're both real, but they both anti-commute with sigma 2, and so then again, this is still true. And so this identity shows you that the representations of SU2, they're generically complex, but they're not arbitrary complex. They're not real, they're pseudo-real. So the complex conjugate is a similarity transformation of the matrix itself. So if I take the matrix, I'm going to call it E, which is just the anti-symmetric matrix. And so that's just I times sigma 2. So if I took E here, I'd lose the minus 1 because of the I. So I have epsilon times epsilon. What's that? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Zero. Yeah. Thank you. So the thing is that this is showing you that complex conjugates, if I put an E on both sides, then I can move the E's over here, and it's showing you that the complex conjugate up to a similarity transformation gives back the same matrix. So it's not real, but it's real up to a similarity transformation, which is what pseudo-real means. So because of that, it's also true that if I define psi bar to be the matrix psi dagger beta, beta has the property that that d dagger beta for Lorentz transformation, that's equal to beta times d inverse. And so that says that what I want to do to find something which transforms oppositely to a spinner is to multiply, to take this combination rather than that. So that's called psi bar. That's the definition of psi bar. And because beta was related to gamma zero, that's also written. So beta is minus I gamma lower zero, or so it's I gamma upper zero. That's psi dagger I psi dagger gamma upper zero, or minus I psi dagger gamma lower zero. And this is again a convention that people differ on, depending on the metric convention and depending on whether you want the Dirac equation to be d slash plus m or I d slash plus m. It's doesn't really matter, but this is the convention we're going to use. With that choice, psi bar under Lorentz transformation goes to psi bar the inverse of lambda. And so now if I take psi bar matrix times psi, the d's, if I write the basis in this way, the d's appearing here are going to cancel the d's appearing here, and we'll get things that are transforming in a simple way. So if I take, for example, psi bar psi, under Lorentz transformation, that's going to go to psi bar, d inverse d psi, because psi is going to d psi, so that's invariant, so that's a scalar. Same thing's true for psi bar gamma 5 psi, because gamma 5 commutes with the d's, so it's a pseudo-scalar in this case, so if it changes sign under parity, but it's a scalar in the sense of the proper transformations. Psi bar gamma mu psi, because of the property of the gamma matrices, this is now going to be a 4-vector. Psi bar gamma mu gamma 5 psi is also a 4-vector. It's an axial 4-vector as opposed to a polar one. Then psi bar gamma mu nu psi is a skew tensor. So one way of thinking of these gamma matrices is that they're the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients for this this symbolism can now be made very explicit. If I have a left-handed and a right-handed guy, they combine to give a four vector, and here's exactly how they combine. This is two different ways they could combine to give you a four vector. And you might have said, well, who's left and who's right? Remember, being left-handed and right-handed is all about being the top. So left-handed is the top guy, right-handed is the bottom guy, because the definition of left and right was the 1/2 0 and the 0/2. So the matrix which distinguishes them is gamma 5. So gamma 5 psi equals psi is another way of saying left-handed. And gamma 5 psi equals minus psi, another way of saying right-handed. And so the projection matrices P, I'm going to call them gamma left. That'll be 1/2 1 plus gamma 5. That projects onto the top part. Gamma right will be 1/2 1 minus gamma 5. That projects onto the bottom part. And so that sets up the, so I guess let me finish this thought. So if you ask who's left-handed and who's right-handed here, the important thing about gamma 5, which you can just check explicitly using these matrices, is that gamma 5 anti-commutes with all the gamma matrices. So whenever gamma 5 moves past the gamma matrix, it changes sign. And so you see that this gamma left, so gamma left times the gamma matrix is equal to gamma mu times gamma right, and vice versa, because the gamma 5 changes sign as you go by. And so that shows you that if you have if I have a gamma left here, I have to have a gamma right here. And so the sense that I have gamma left and a gamma right on either side is the thing that's picking out the 1/2 0 across the 0/2. Whereas here, you know, if I had gamma left, I'd have to have a gamma left here because they commute. So this is saying that if I take a 1/2 0 times a 1/2 0, I can have a scalar, which is a 0/0. And that's kind of what we expected, that from the rules of Anger-Momentum combination, that should have been a 0/0 plus a 1/0, because we know that a spin a half and a spin a half, the anti-symmetric combination is a spin 0, and the symmetric combination is a spin 1. And so here's the spin 0, and here's the spin 1 from the point of view of the left-handed fields. And then here's the 1/2 1/2 you get from taking a 0/0 with a 0/2. And so these, from that point of view, these gamma matrices are the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that tell you how to combine the different spins. And there's one thought I haven't given you yet.
Oh, sorry. So the gamma matrices for the relation you just wrote on the top left of the this one. So the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients for that would be the identity, the gamma 5 and the gamma mu.
Yeah, gamma 5 and identity are here, and gamma mu is here. And you might have said, well, the gamma mu, that's got six things in it, and that only has three because it's a spin one thing, as opposed to if I'd done 0/2 0/2, I would have got a 0/1, which is three more. And what's happening is this is really the sum, right? This is really a 0/2 0 plus 0/2. So it has both this and the one with all the numbers on the other side. So this plus this is this. And if you want to know how to reduce them, how do you pick just this out of this? What you do is you just take two left-handed guys. So if you take if I'd written gamma left, gamma mu nu, gamma left. So I force it to be between two left-handed guys, as opposed to having gamma right and gamma right. Then if I can track that with epsilon mu nu lambda rho. And here's a convention I'm going to get wrong. And I want to make sure I not lie to you about these conventions, because part of the point of this is to give you correct statements about these identities. So I'm just giving you now a matrix identity, and that is and I'm not going to find it now. That's here we go. Oh, come on. So I hesitate to write it because I don't want to write it incorrectly. So let me see if I can find it in the other notes. So there's a sign here, which is plus or minus, and I'm going to get it wrong if I write it down, times I times gamma left gamma lambda rho gamma left. So this is just a matrix identity. And that sign is whatever it is for gamma left. If I make these gamma rights, the sign changes. And so the statement is that this is a self-dual tensor, and this is an anti-self-dual tensor in the sense that T mu nu is equal to that same sign, epsilon mu nu lambda rho, P lambda rho. So depending on the sign, a tensor which satisfies this, depending on the sign, is either a 1, 0, or a 0, 1. And the way you decide which is the 1, 0 is the one that you got from this guy, so it's a sign you would have read off from here. And I'll come back to you with what that sign is, because it's I don't want to say it incorrectly. There's also another identity which is useful, which I should tell you just as in passing. And what I'm surprised by is that I'm not... Yeah, I thought it was written down here, but it's another useful identity is that you can write gamma 5 in terms of the gamma, in fact, this is probably the way to derive what the sign is, so let's try and do that. So here's another identity you can just do by multiplying out the matrices. So minus gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, that is gamma 5. So if you just write that out, that's what you get. So that says that, so on the other hand, there's got to be a tensorial way to think about this, right? Because this is a Lorentz scalar. This looks like it's a kind of random combination of the various gamma matrices, but you can make a Lorentz scalar out of that by contracting it with the epsilon. So if I take epsilon mu nu lambda rho times gamma mu gamma nu gamma lambda gamma rho, that's a Lorentz scalar, where epsilon is the antisymmetric, the completely antisymmetric tensor. Are you happy with that being a completely antisymmetric, that being a Lorentz invariant tensor, the epsilon? You know, the statement is that you know, the definition lambda mu nu, lambda alpha beta, eta nu beta equals eta mu alpha. That says that these lambdas satisfy, you know, they satisfy the algebra, but in particular, it says that the determinant of lambda is plus or minus one, right? And the determinant of lambda, one way of writing it would be, rather than getting this wrong, the statement is that the statement that the determinant of lambda is plus or minus one, but it's a Lorentz invariant, is the statement that epsilon mu nu lambda rho is a Lorentz invariant tensor. So that's what it is. If I take lambda mu nu lambda lambda rho lambda sigma alpha lambda beta delta times epsilon nu rho alpha delta. Epsilon is defined to be, my conventions are going to be epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is equal to plus 1 when they're upstairs. So that means that epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3, which you get by lowering it with a metric, is equal to minus 1. And it's completely antisymmetric. Antisymmetric. And so that means that any two indices are the same at 0. And all the ones that are different permutations you get from these by taking the right sign that you had to do by changing all the orders. So that's the definition of the tensor, of the object. And now this, if you just algebraically, these properties say that this is the determinant of lambda times epsilon mu lambda sigma beta. So if this had been 1, that's what it means to be invariant tensor. I do a Lorentz transformation and I get the same thing back. So in the same way that this is saying, this property says that eta mu nu is a Lorentz invariant tensor. It's not a covariant tensor, it's an invariant tensor because it transforms, but when you do it, you get the same numerical thing back. And so this property and the fact that the determinant being one for the subset of them, those are two ways of saying that these two things are invariant tensors for the Lorentz group. So having said that, this has to be under proper transformations a determinant is one, and so this should be invariant, but it should have a the ones for which the determinant is negative, it should change sign, and that's when I told you that gamma 5 was a pseudo scalar rather than a scalar. That's kind of because of that. So these things, they're both transforming invariantly under the Lorentz group. They both involve the same number of products. The, you know, the numerically, this is 0, 1, 2, 3 would agree with this up to a minus sign. That's that minus sign. So if I take I times this, this is equal to that for one choice. Then there's a whole bunch of permutations. And those permutations will be some factor. So I guess it'll be 4 factorial. So this must be I over 4 factorial. So the claim is that that is equal to that. And so they have to be equal to each other because they're the only Lorentz invariant scalar in the problem, the pseudo-scalar in the problem. And so I told you that because that tells us what the sign is here now. So if I take in a very backhanded way. In principle, you can figure that sign up from this, but I'm not going to do it on the board because I thought it was going to be more obvious than it was. Rather than doing that, let me sink the remaining 10 minutes into left versus right-handed spinners, and we're done with the definitions. So you know, this four-component thing we've got, it's completely reducible under the Lorentz group because with those guys transform amongst themselves, those guys transform amongst themselves. So because it's reducible, it's possible in a Lorentz invariant way to throw some of the pieces away. One way to do that is to set these guys to zero, right? So if I define psi left to be 1/2, you know, what I call gamma left on psi, that's 1/2 1 plus gamma 5 on psi. Gamma 5, this is just the matrix, you know, 1, 0, 0, 0 on psi. That just gives me psi left 0. Now if I define psi right to be gamma right on psi, which is 1/2 1 minus gamma 5 on psi, which is the matrix 0, 0, 0, 1 on psi, that's just 0 psi right. Gamma 5 commutes with Lorentz transformations. That's a completely Lorentz invariant thing to do, because Lorentz transformations, if this is zero, it's consistent to leave it zero, because Lorentz transformations won't change that. So these are what you call a Weyl spinner. A left-handed one and a right-handed one. But they're complex conjugates of each other. So, because, remember the, K was an anti-Hermitian. If you kind of ask, if I take the complex conjugates of the left-handed guys, I'm getting right-handed Lorentz matrices. So the 1/2 0 under complex conjugation switches with a 0 1/2. Under complex conjugation. And you can be really explicit about that because of this identity here. You know, you give me any generator of the Lorentz group in this spin a half thing, which is built out of Pauli matrices, this tells you exactly how to get something which transformed under the complex conjugate transformation. And so in particular, you know, if U left transforms the way that the, you know, I take the left-handed part of the Lorentz transformation and act on it, then the matrix E, that E, times U left star transforms like U right, is the statement. And so that means that another way I could make this thing, I could reduce this thing, another Lorentz invariant constraint for this thing would have been a reality condition. If I make this guy, the complex conjugate of this guy, up to a matrix, that's a Lorentz invariant thing to do. So, let's do that. So a Majorana spinner is what these are called. Is one for which I have psi left and minus this matrix epsilon, which I just erased. psi left star. So the right and the left-handed parts are not independent of one another. And that's also a Lorentz invariant thing to do, because if I do Lorentz transformations of this one and this one, they do the same thing because of the fact that the epsilon is kind of compensating for the fact that I've complex conjugated the transformation rules. And it turns it into a right-handed transformation rule. So the reason, if I wanted to write what that meant for the whole spinner, if I'm calling this whole thing psi, another way of writing this is that if I take psi star, you know, what do I get? I'm going to get psi left star minus epsilon. It's a real matrix times psi left. So that's the matrix. Make sure I write it right. Oh, of course, I'm going to do this backwards. Let me do this the way I've got it in my notes, so I don't lie to you. So I can just write this as a matrix acting on psi left minus epsilon psi left star star. And that matrix will be a 0 epsilon minus epsilon 0. So this matrix is often called the charge conjugation matrix, C. So that's, so that means that the statement that psi star, so C squared I think is 1. C squared, you're going to get minus epsilon squared is 1. Yeah, so it's C squared is 1. So psi star equals C psi is a Lorentz, is Lorentz invariant condition. If one frame says that that's true, all frames will say it's true because it's consistent with Lorentz transformation rules. So you have two ways to think of, you can always take a Dirac spinner, the one with four components, and think of it as being something with two components in two logically independent but related ways. One of them is I just take the left-handed part all the time, and then the complex conjugate of that will be the right-handed part. Or I can just do that all at once and say I'll just impose a reality condition on the spinner, and they have the same information in them. So if I want to take a Lagrangian and build it out of psi lefts, I can take all my, you know, what's happening here is that we had in the original Dirac field for the electron, we had the electron and the positron, but you knew that I could have logically had particles, spin a half particles that were their own antiparticles if they had no charges. And the field that you would have represented, so they should have half as many degrees of freedom because now the positron and electron are the same thing. Just like a real field is different from a complex field, or a scalar field can't be real if its particle and antiparticle are different, but it can be real if they are the same. The same thing's true here. If I had a spin a half particle that was equal to its antiparticle, I could represent it with just a Majorana spinner. I wouldn't need two of them. Whereas a Dirac spinner is actually two of them. If I took two fields, psi 1 and psi 2, that satisfied that, and I take psi 1 plus I psi 2, that's a generic Dirac spinner. And so I can always take a Dirac spinner and break it into two Majorana spinners. But if all I need is one to describe a particle, then that particle is a Majorana particle. So there's two different ways in which Majoranas are used. So if A P sigma is equal to A bar P sigma, so that it's its own antiparticle, that's a Majorana particle. And it's only possible if that thing does not carry a charge. And so a physical question is, are neutrinos Majorana particles? And the reason it's a physical question is that one of the questions we don't know is whether or not lepton number is conserved. And if the neutrinos carry lepton number, they cannot be Majorana particles if lepton number is conserved. So a related question to whether the neutrinos are their own antiparticles is lepton number conserved? And so that's a physical question. But you can always take any combination of spin a half particles and represent them with a collection of Majorana fields, just because it's like taking any combination of fields and writing them in terms of real fields. If you had complex ones, you could take the real and imaginary parts of them. It's just a way of the basis of writing the fields. Or you could equivalently take left-handed fields, but when you write a Lagrangian, those will all be complex. If I complex conjugate them, I'm going to write right-handed fields. So I'll have to take a Lagrangian built out of left-handed fields, and when I'm finished, it'll be complex. I'll have to add the complex conjugate. If I do it in terms of Majorana fields, because those are real already, I can just make the Lagrangian real. And it has both the complex conjugate and the original thing taken together. So it's usually convenient to use the Majorana spinners, but you often see people using these. Whenever you see something with an index which is dotted or undotted, what they're really doing is one of them is a left-handed spinner, one is a right-handed spinner, and they're putting all the indices back in, which you might like to do, but it's not necessary. And so I will often use Majorana spinners, and they have, the punchline is I get to write these identities I want to write down. Majorana spinners have reality. When I take bilinears of them, they have specific reality and symmetry properties. So the claim is, and this you should prove, but the things I'm going to tell you are true. If I have, if psi 1 and psi 2, if psi 1 and psi 2 are Majorana spinners, then if I take psi 1 bar matrix psi 2 and I complex conjugate it, the claim is I'm going to get, I'll call it what I called it in the notes here. Call that chi psi 1 bar m psi 2. And chi is going to be plus or minus 1, depending on what m is. It's also true that these things are m psi 2. I'll call this one lambda psi 2 bar m psi 1. So all I'm doing here is just changing 1 to 2. Here I didn't change 1 to 2, but I complex conjugated it. And so the statement is that if I take the scalar, I take the matrix 1, gamma 5, gamma mu, gamma 5, and gamma mu nu. So if m is equal to these things, then zeta chi will be, and zeta or lambda will be. So this one, 1 is plus, minus, plus, minus, plus. The gamma 5s basically are the ones that are imaginary, and the ones without gamma 5s are not. And this one, the 1 is plus, plus, minus, plus, minus. So the vector and the tensor are anti-symmetric and the other two are symmetric. And in saying this, this is one reason why you should prove these statements, is part of the story involves also the statistics of the fields. So the fact that they're anti-commuting fields, that's one of the signs in your problem. So these statements are taking into account that these were spinner fields that were fermions, so they're anti-commuting fields. So those are very useful. No, I'm saying that if there's 16 different bilinears you could make depending on what the matrix was, and then if I let the matrix be any one of these, then they transform in a very specific way under Lorentz transformations. So choose one. So if you choose gamma mu, then I claim that if this is psi bar 1.
Oh, that's an M.
This is an M. Yeah, sorry. So for this M, if it's either one of these choices, then the sign you would get are these ones. That's the statement. And those are super useful. So if I want to write a Lagrangian down, say, and I want it to have a piece in it, which is, you know, psi bar gamma 5 psi, it has to come with a factor of I and a real coefficient in order for the Lagrangian to be real. Because that I is corresponding to the fact that for gamma 5, I've got a minus sign here. So the operator itself is imaginary. So I needed to have an imaginary coefficient to make it real. And if I had, but if I tried to do something like, you know, A mu, and I have only one field, psi bar mu, gamma mu, psi, one. So let's say I try and write down electromagnetic coupling with a single Majorana spinner, I get zero because this operator is anti-symmetric because of that. So this is actually equal to minus itself, so that's actually the zero operator. And that's one way of seeing that I can't take a Majorana, I can't have a particle be described by a Majorana field unless it has no charge. And this is the algebra telling you that you can't write down electromagnetic coupling for that object. You'd have to have at least two of them, a particle and an antiparticle, where you can write that down, because that's something which is antisymmetric but not zero, under 1 to 2. So the what's convenient about the Majorana spinners is that they have, you know, explicit symmetry and reality properties. So when you're writing a Lagrangian down, it's, you can be very explicit about what the coefficients are, if they're real or not. Or anisymmetric is sometimes useful as well to know. So that's probably a good place to stop. So now we're in a business, we can calculate things. I think that's all the foundational things I wanted to do.